Hi, Bobby Halton here for our sponsor, Unimac. We know that health and safety are always top of mind for firefighters. Well, the same is true for the folks at Unimac. That's why they offer a tailored PPE gear cleaning solution, complete with their industrial washer extractor with OptiSpray. It's proven to remove 22% more residual chemistry than a bath rinse. Plus, Unimac provides tools like FireLink and certified training courses to make following and tracking NFPA 1851 standards a breeze. When health and safety are on the line, demand the total package. To learn more, visit unimac.com/tailored.
Hey everyone, welcome to the Built Environment on Fire Engineering Blog Talk Radio. It's been a while since we've had a show, so I'm really looking forward to tonight and talking to a couple good friends of mine, that guys that I've learned a lot from and just really enjoy being around. So today on the show, we have Barry Franke again, who's become my co-host for the show. And then we have Tim Adams, and I'm going to have those guys just do an introduction for themselves. But we tried doing the show a number of months ago, and we ran into a whole mess of technical difficulties. So we're doing it again. We're going to pre-record it this time so we can control the audio and edit it. And because it's a topic that I know there's lots of interest about, it's something that's kind of near and dear to our hearts on the call, because we spend time in the city, not COVID year, but every other year we spend time at a conference, a symposium there. But it's going to be the near miss or the injury that happened to Captain Pete Dern in Fresno. So I'll go with Barry if you want to introduce yourself again, and then we'll move to Timmy, and then we'll talk a little bit more about the incident.
Thanks, James. Yeah, I'm Barry Franke. I worked in the fire service for 34 years, retired out of San Jose Fire Department as a captain. I've been retired for 12 and a half years now, so I'm kind of losing a little bit of touch, but, you know, thankfully James and Tim and guys like those are keeping me involved in the fire service, so I'm still having a really good time. I worked in the construction trade for 20-something years, and I've been teaching building construction for probably about 15 years or so. And last 3 years, James and I have been teaching building construction together, and it's been a lot of fun. So that's pretty much where I'm coming from.
Awesome. And then our guest for today we have is Battalion Chief Tim Adams. So, Timmy, if you want to give a little introduction.
Sure. Appreciate you guys having me on, and more importantly, your friendship. Definitely your building construction, everything you guys bring is a miss in the fire service, I think, in today with size ups and everything else. But a little bit about myself, I've been in the fire service since the early 90s, volunteer time, paid call, things like that. Worked for a department in southern Los Angeles County, Santa Fe Springs, then lateral over to Anaheim. Really diverse department. A lot of entertainment, a lot of diversity from many different structures, mid-rise, high-rise, wildland interface, hazmat, USAR, all that stuff. So I've been very fortunate in my career to be involved with a lot of the specialty teams, and my passion is training and, more importantly, safety with all-risk services is kind of where I shoot from the hip at. And that's why I was very privileged and honored to be part of this incident in Fresno to really heighten and hone skills. And that's what I'm looking forward to sharing a little bit of perspective and more of the cultural values that stem from that. So, yeah, thanks for having me.
Awesome. Yeah, we're excited to have you. And Tim, just something you said, that's something that I've always appreciated about you is I always hear you say that, where you say that, like, training is obviously your big thing, but you always say safety is a big thing for you too. And I think sometimes when you hear people say, talk about safety, it's like, where there's this whole, this whole like culture or thing that you see where it's like, if, you know, it's kind of like that old joke on the construction site, like nobody moves, nobody gets hurt, sort of thing. But the thing I loved when I got to know you and got to work with AFC and the group is there's no lack of aggressiveness. There's no lack of going in and doing the job and doing all those things. But you guys, you push everybody being so competent at their job that, you know, safety comes through competence. And that's something that I've always like really kind of picked up from you and appreciated. Because like I said, you're, you know, big with the safety stuff, but it's not by avoiding things. It's by training and getting really good at it so that it is safe. So,
yeah,
it's something I've always liked.
Yeah. You know, James, that's a really important point. And I feel the same way. And I feel really, really lucky to be working with all of the guys that are involved with AFC. You know, you got guys from Sacramento, Anaheim, San Jose, you from Vancouver, just San Francisco. You got guys from all different departments, and they're all a bunch of real aggressive firefighters. But they understand, you know, when you're out there doing the job, you've got to have your head on a swivel, and you've got to be paying attention. And so that's a really good point. That's great.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if I could, based on what you guys are summarizing there and the importance of safety in all risk and speaking to structural firefighting and single family dwellings in review of the incident, but when you really look at some of the causal and contributing factors across the fire service and all of our fire fatalities are serious accident reviews where there's been major injuries that have been life-altering, not only to the firefighter and its department, but the families in which these firefighters come from, you know, you really start breaking that down. And if you're not putting safety in your culture and not making it part of your normal everyday thought process that evaluates weather, building construction, response time, and all those potentials, you know, FireScope's PACE process, if you're not looking at primary, alternate, contingency, and emergency planning, that's part of the way you think, like your DNA as a professional, then we're really missing the boat, because most of these fires, when you review them, when they don't go right, most of the time you're hearing it's not in a live rescue where we're going to take, you know, a lot of risk. There's potential for our first responders to get injured. Early on in radio traffic or arriving on scene, you hear everyone's out of the building. And that's something that I think the fire service as a whole, I don't care if you're West Coast, East Coast, Canada, Europe, it doesn't matter. Once you've got an all clear of that building, the older you get, the more you realize it's pretty cool going home. And the only life that we're risking is your own or the first responders that we're managing and trying to check all these boxes on. So I think that's really a great foundation for where our chat's going this evening, is to think about that. You know, when you're there, aggressive shouldn't be blind. Aggressive should mean something, know your end state and where you're going, so that the only people that are getting injured for no savable life is the firefighter. And that's, quite frankly, just unacceptable for today's environment and the knowledge base and the experience that's been put into the fire service through OSHA regulation, and more importantly, all the studies that have come out from back east with the science and the millions of dollars they've poured in with guys like Kerber and them. So
definitely.
You know, Tim, that brings up another point to me, and I don't know how many times James and I, you know, when we cover some of the incidents that we cover in our class, how many times we say, what's the life hazard in this building now? It's us. There's nobody else in there, just us. So, you know, we have to think about that a little bit more than I think we have in the past, at least from my generation.
Yeah, and, you know, a lot of people say, well, there's property, there's valuables, there's wedding pictures. Absolutely, but you got to calculate the save on property and whether you're going to contain it to a room of origin, an area of origin, a floor of origin, a structure of origin. You got to pick the wins where you're truly making a difference without injuring people.
Yeah.
And every fire is going to be different. You know, same street, same area, doesn't matter. Every day is different, night and day, wind, retrofitting, remodel, add-on, pack ratting. There's never the same conditions.
Nope.
Totally. So, Tim, we're going to talk about the Pete Dern incident. Can you give us a little background? How did you become involved in this, and what was your role during the reviewing process of it?
So, I mean, first and foremost, it's like anything in the fire service. It's timing and dumb luck. And at the time of the incident, Randy Brugman was the fire chief of Anaheim, and he was a former fire chief of Fresno. So Chief Donis and her leadership reached out as she was trying to assemble people that could come up and be a part of an external non-Fresno-based SART team, and they were looking for a panel to assemble. The fire chief had asked the ops chief, and the ops chief, with everything he had going on, was busy, and so it kind of defaulted that he wanted to support the Fresno Fire Department, as many agencies did and were willing to, and so that's how I was selected to go up to represent Anaheim. And my knowledge and background in training, working at the time as on the board and president of the Southern California Training Officers Association under Cal Chiefs, you know, there's a lot of areas that we were able to bring and had some pre-established relationships. So it's not like the fire service reached out and my name's at the top of any list or I'm well known. I'm just another average Joe that's an early adopter on material and am willing to invest in the fire service because I believe in our profession. So I was able to go up and participate in what was really a professional life-changing event over 10 months.
Excellent. So what I'm going to do now is we have the official report, the one that Tim was involved with. And in the report, they have the incident overview. And it'll probably take me a couple minutes to read it, but I want to read it for everyone that may not be familiar with the incident. And it'll go through, it explains which rigs are there, gives a little bit of timing of, you know, who arrived at what time, which order, and some of the tasks that were done. So I'll read that, and then we'll get into discussing it a little bit further and kind of how it ties into building construction and tactics and that stuff. So we'll go into it. Incident overview. At 1322 hours on March 29th, 2015, the Fresno Police Dispatch Center received a 911 call reporting a residential fire at 1310 East Cortland Ave, Fresno, California. At 1324, Fresno Fire dispatched engines 4, 9, 20, truck 4, truck 11, battalion 3, to 1310 East Cortland Ave. Engine 5 was just clearing a call a few blocks from the Cortland address and was added to the dispatch. Engine 4 was canceled. Battalion 1 was nearby and was added. Battalion 3 was canceled. The dispatch now consisted of engines 5, 9, 20, trucks 4, 11, and Battalion 1. Engine 5 with a crew of 4 was first on scene at 1326 hours. The captain from Engine 5 assumed incident command and gave a size up, reporting heavy smoke showing, possibly in the attic. Engine 5 had secured their own water supply from a hydrant in front of the residence. Engine 5 Firefighter 1 advanced a 1.5-inch hand line to the front door of the resident on the D side of the structure. Engine 5 Firefighter 2 followed with an inside ladder and a rubbish hook. The inside ladder was left near the front door, and both firefighters proceeded inside the residence. The IC advised the second arriving engine to assist with fire attack. Fresno dispatch informed the IC that they had reports of people still inside the structure. The IC had a face-to-face with one of the occupants and confirmed that everyone was out of the structure, reported on Fire 1 that everybody has evacuated the structure. Dispatch acknowledged that everyone was out of the structure. The IC gave direction on Fire 1 for the first in truck to take ventilation, and the third in engine to go ahead and take utilities. Fire attack. Engine 5 Firefighter 1 proceeded through the residence to an exterior door on the B side of the structure with the hose line. He observed heavy fire and smoke coming from the main door of the attached garage. At 1328 hours, he applied water into the garage for 11 seconds, but was short of hose. Engine 5 Firefighter 2 and the IC assisted pulling hose through the front door of the residence. Engine 5 Firefighter 2 proceeded to pull ceiling and check for extension. Engine 20 arrived on scene with a crew of three and assumed fire attack. The captain from Engine 20 sent one firefighter in to assist firefighters 1 and 2 from Engine 5 with fire attack. The captain and engineer stayed outside to establish two out. Engine 20 captain started to make a 360 around the structure, but it was not completed. The IC assisted Engine 20 to take fire attack and two out. The Engine 20 captain replied, "Copy, assist fire attack and two out." IC reports most of the fire is in the garage with possible extension into the attic. Fire attack, Engine 5 Firefighter 1 reports the bulk of the fire is knocked down in the garage and the fire does not appear to have extended into the attic. Engine 9 arrived on scene with a crew of four and secured utilities. Captain of Engine 9 took independent action to create an opening on the top of the roll-up door with hand tools. Truck 11 arrived on scene with a crew of four and staged. Truck 11 crew prepared for assignment in front of their apparatus. Battalion Chief 1 arrived on scene and proceeded to the IC's location. Truck 4 arrived on scene with a crew of four and asked, "Command, Truck 4, do you want vertical vent?" No response from command. From the B-side man door and window, the smoke condition showed pressurized, turbulent brown and gray smoke exiting the door. Fire attack Engine 5 Firefighter 1 applied water in a fog pattern to the ceiling area of the garage for an additional four more seconds. Fire attack Engine 5 Firefighter 1 reported to the IC that it appears there are multiple rooms in the garage and the fire is not knocked down. Fire attack Engine 5 Firefighter 1 moved the hose line into the residence. Engine 20 captain reported on the radio that two out is established. IC stated on the radio, "We're working on attempting to open the front of the garage at this time, and the truck is going to ventilate." IC stated, "Truck 4, do you copy to ventilate the garage?" IC verbalizes the utilities are secure. Truck 4 proceeded to ladder the residential portion of the structure on the D side. The crew had two chainsaws at the base of the ladder with rubbish hooks. Truck 4 captain donned his SCBA face piece at the base of the ladder and proceeded up the ladder with a rubbish hook. Once on the roof, he sounded the roof with his rubbish hook as he quickly advanced from the ladder to the ridge line of the roof, also moving north towards the garage area. Truck 4 Firefighter 1 also donned his SCBA and followed the captain up the ladder with the chainsaw. Truck 4 Firefighter 1 was behind the captain approximately 10 to 12 feet. Truck 4 Engineer 1 was at the base of the ladder attempting to start the chainsaw. Truck 4 Engineer 2 was also at the base of the ladder. At this point, the fire in the garage was pushing heavy amounts of pressurized, turbulent, brown and gray, dark smoke through all portions of the garage, including the roofline, attic vent, doors, windows, and eaves. At 1332 hours, the captain from Truck 4 was sounding his way through the roof of the garage or towards the roof of the garage through moderate to heavy smoke. Truck 4 Firefighter 1 with the chainsaw was approximately 10 to 12 feet behind the captain. The captain sounded the roof right over the area of the firewall between the attached garage and the residence, approximately 12 to 18 inches to his right and a little forward of his right foot. He stepped forward and immediately fell through the roof into the garage into heavy fire conditions. This took place 8 minutes after dispatch. Fire impingement to the unprotected structural members of the roof is estimated to have been approximately 12 to 15 minutes. Per the IC, Truck 4 Firefighter 1 remained on the roof. Truck 4 Engineer 1 made access to the roof and assisted with ventilation over the residence. The IC and Battalion 1, who had not taken command yet, were both on the front lawn and witnessed the captain go through the roof. They both nearly simultaneously broadcasted a mayday for the firefighter through the roof of the garage. BC1 stated, "Mayday, mayday, mayday, we have a firefighter in the garage, start an EMS unit." fire attack, Engine 5 Firefighter 1 heard civilian screaming outside of the front door. He repositioned his hose line back outside the front door and applied water towards the hole created in the roof. Engine 20 Captain, two out, retreats from the front porch area, leaving the 1.5-inch hose line behind, picking up a second hose line near the roll-up garage door and applies water through a small opening in the garage roll-up door. At 1333 hours, using axes and manpower, the roll-up garage door was removed and additional water was directed into the garage. Battalion 3 arrived on scene and assigned Engine 20 Captain to RIC 1 face-to-face. He assigned Truck 11 to become the RIC team. At 1334, Battalion 3 requested an ambulance through dispatch. Fire attack, Engine 5 Firefighter 1 applied water for 9 seconds through the man door on the B side of the garage, and then Firefighter Engine 1 and Firefighter 1 and Firefighter 2 made entry into the garage and made contact with Truck 4 Captain. At the same time, Truck 11 Firefighter made his way through the residence to the man door of the garage where he observed two firefighters attempting to remove the injured captain. He made entry into the garage and assisted with the rescue, lifting the captain over a pallet and other debris, and exited the garage through the man door. BC-1 assumed command of the incident from Engine 5 Captain, and a second alarm was requested. Engine 9 Firefighter 1 made access through the removed roll-up door and by independent action assisted with the rescue of Truck 4 Captain. The three firefighters removed the captain from the garage at 1335 hours. He was moved onto the driveway where cooling measures were initiated while waiting for the ambulance unit. At 1337 hours, the ambulance was on scene and the injured captain was transported to the hospital at 1340 hours. From the time of the incident until arrival at the hospital was approximately 15 minutes. So that's the overview. What's your guys' thoughts hearing that? I know it's been a number of years since then. Barry, what's going through your head as that's all going on?
Well, I remember, you know, watching the video, and it's gut wrenching to, you know, see what happened there. You know, first of all, I think we have to tell everybody that Fresno Fire Department hosts the conference every year. I've been going there for probably 15 years or more. They're a really tight fire department, camaraderie, pride, busy. They fight a lot of fires, so. I think we need to make sure everybody knows that they are a really squared away group of people, and the conference they put on couldn't be better. It just, they are super, super really good people. I don't really know the answer to how do we prevent this kind of thing. I mean, I watched Captain Dern up there. He's going through all the stuff that he should be going through. But again, we talk about the first thing to go is the decking, and maybe that's probably what happened, is that decking failed, and he could have sounded the roof, and just a split second he hit it with his foot, that decking failed, and so I wish I had an answer. I just don't, James.
Mm-hmm. Awesome, Tim. So what are your, it's probably something you haven't thought about or reviewed in a little bit. What's kind of some of the stuff went through your head hearing that again and going through it?
Yeah, it brings up a lot of emotion. And to be honest with you, it's actually something that I think about all the time. Kind of as I stated, not only for that department, was it life altering, culturally changing, no one more than the Dern family. But the Cortland incident is something that should resonate with everybody. And without being condescending, I'm super proud of the Fresno Fire Department, Chief Donis, Chief Cabral, who's their current ops chief, who served in numerous positions there, that has always supported the Fresno Training Symposium, as Barry has brought up. But it's actually been on the forefront here again, because Chief Donis just published not too long ago an update of the Cortland incident 5 years later in the Fresno Fire Department. And, you know, it should really be noted that they haven't forgotten, and they're not going to allow history to repeat itself. I encourage people to go Google and search the article. I actually do give it. It's called First Due, Cortland Incident 5 Years Later, that Chief Donis put out on December 1st of 2020. And out of all the recommendations that the SART had made, you know, they're 99%, 98, 99% complete with a refacing of their organization. And it's not just at the policy level. It's not just, you know, tweaking some training programs and whatnot. They have, when they opened their doors after that tragic event and the SART came in, they wholeheartedly said, don't hold back. We want a true, factual, fair, independent evaluation of not just the incident, but our organization. And we literally went through, you know, thousands of pages of records. We went through 10 years of NIOSH reports to compare it to, you know, what information has the fire service and the industry provided that we don't engage with. And, you know, that's that cultural norm, the attitude and behavior that forms cultures in which I have resonated to treat all of my teachings, the way I run my battalion, the way I try to share with people. And let's face it, not everybody agrees or it doesn't resonate the same way. But I will tell you that Chief Donis and her executive team and all the members of that department have really redone and transformed. They didn't take away their heritage. They didn't take away their rich traditions, but they reevaluated the way they look at how they do business, the way they do after-action review, the way they look at communication and accountability, the safety measures they take from when the bells go off. Even before that, they're pre-planning the way they train, but when the emergency does come in, how they standardize, what risks they're taking. They have to justify their actions based on best industry practices, not just that's the way we've always done it. You know, we've heard that stuff. You reading that review, you know, I made a page of notes, and I've got, you know, 1,000 pages of notes probably, over-exaggerating a little bit, but we've spent a lot of time, and it brings up a lot of things and a lot of key points that, as we continue our discussion today or this evening, I just want to make it known that this isn't just about Fresno or Cortland. I mean, this is in general procedure, general assumption across the American Fire Service. I know it was happening and is still happening in my organization and the county I work in. And, you know, we treat ICS and tactical worksheets as checking boxes. And if we don't know why we're doing it, or your answers are because that's the way we've been told to do it, or that's the way we've always done it, you're missing the boat. Because what Fresno did is they looked at it and they went outside so they can truly look at how are we comparing to other organizations, to the other organizations that are suffering from injury, illness, and fatalities, who have had like issues. And you think about the literally millions of unreported near misses that go on. And, you know, we high five and are laughing in the front yard with that public perception of somebody's worst day, losing their property in their house, have damage. And we have melted helmets or crazed face pieces. Those were serious, life-threatening near misses that we're acting like we're just fighting fire and that's part of the job. And it's quite frankly unacceptable. So organizations, as from the individual firefighter to the organization and the op area itself that are all doing auto and mutual aid together, they have to get outside their own agency bubbles and their own policies and look at what's going on around them so we don't repeat history. Because it's important to note in the Fresno Cortland report, you know, that was gone through and we literally tried to do the fairest analysis to keep it factual and maintain that professional integrity of why we were there and the assistance we were providing. So we broke it down to looking at the NIOSH reports, and it's all in the report and all the history and which incident and what was there and different color coding highlight to make it an easy read as possible. But, you know, when it came down to it, we went back from that day in March, 10 years, a single decade, because Vincent Dunn, you know, everybody knows him from New York. He says it takes a decade to change the face of the fire service, or a big organization and smaller ones that work together in these op areas, as I mentioned. It takes a decade. So we took a decade just to kind of go with that perception. And of those NIOSH reports, we took out everything that wasn't interior structural firefighting related to really give us a benchmark foundation of where the American Fire Service was at, especially how we were applying task and tactics within a strategic operation for West Coast firefighting, since that's where this city is. And, you know, it broke it down that of the 77 cases that were reviewed that were interior structural firefighting, 70 of those cases, and remember NIOSH reports was an actual fatality, which this very well should have been. Thank God it wasn't. But of the 77 cases reviewed to Cortland, 70 of those incidents had common denominators, common causal and contributing factors that led to a first responder getting seriously injured. And that's where we, as we stated, you know, there's probably thousands that are undocumented near misses like this that just went unreported or aren't evaluated in the same manner. So when you look at it, breaks it down to PPE and safety gear. 16 of those cases, like Cortland, had that. Independent action and freelancing, 18. Leadership and safety, 5. Incident command post, 12. Accountability procedures, 28. Size up and 360, 27. You know, and the list continues to go on. A risk management process that, you know, what are we there to save, and is there a savable life to save? You know, just because there's a rescue doesn't mean we should be in rescue mode based on conditions and the survivability profile in that building that you're going to commit your first responders to, and that was 27. Mm-hmm. Recognition of modern fire science, you know, 4, but in that decade, with the studies that have come out, that wasn't even being evaluated in the same way. So, I mean, it's just I can talk for hours to strike. What it really comes back to is, what's your train of thought? Am I taking the proper task level things competently trained to an industry standard under a tactical priority to meet that strategic objective under command, and where I fit into that? So I'll let you take it back here and strike some more conversation, or I'll just keep rambling on.
Perfect. So what I'd like to do is, that's all super great. What I'd like to do is, most of the people that are going to be tuning in and listening to this are going to be firefighters, company officers, chief officers. But I'd like to try and give some tangible takeaways from this. You know, like key takeaways that they can, you know, go back and apply or look at. So first thing, because the show is the built environment, and we talk a lot about building construction and stuff. I'd like to start with that, because one thing, just when it's kind of been mentioned, but you know, Monday morning quarterback is not something we want to do. We're just looking at what happened and how we can learn from it. But my initial reaction, when I first saw the video, I could, just looking at obviously I'm a big building construction nerd, but looking at it, and you see him heading up over top of the garage. And for me, that's always been something I think about, because from a building code perspective, through North America, it's not required to have any drywall or passive fire protection in the garage. either on the walls or on the roof structure. So that's obviously going to be an area that's going to be more compromised by the fire at a faster rate. And so that was something right away that I noticed, that, you know, what the reaction and the feeling and the conditions that you're going to get over the occupied living space and over the garage could be vastly different. So I have the overview here of just the building construction. So I just want to read that, and then we'll just talk about that a little bit further. So the structure involved at the Cortland incident was a 1,377 square foot, one-story single-family residence with an attached 400 square foot garage. The structure was built in 1970 and had the following building construction components at the time of the incident: 2x4 stud and stucco exterior walls, half-inch drywall within the residence, no drywall in the garage except for the firewall between the residence and the garage, 2x4 gang nail truss roof, half-inch plywood roof sheathing, one layer of roofing paper, and 5 layers of composition roof shingles.
Wow.
So that's basically knowing, you know, kind of that area and knowing at lots of California and lots of just West Coast in general, even all the way up to here, that's very, very common construction for that time, for that kind of era of building. But yeah, that was just when I looked at it, the first thing I thought was seeing them head up over top of that garage and then knowing how that structure changes. So that was something that I kind of took away from that.
You know, there was another incident in another city fairly close to Fresno, and I want to say Madera or someplace like that.
Modesto.
There you go, where those two firefighters fell through the roof. And I got a chance to talk to one of them, and it was just brutal listening to, you know, all the stuff that he went through. And he was back on the job, but the guy is going to be affected for the rest of his life. And I'm sure that that building, in looking at it, was very, very similar to the building we're talking about today. Very similar.
Yeah, and I think, you know, as you bring these things up, again, it's important to note, you look at how the team was assembled by Fresno. We had two individuals from Modesto, one the retired fire chief, who was the leadership of Modesto at time of that incident.
Mm-hmm.
Very emotional for him, reliving that as he shared with us, and we reviewed the Cortland, and then who was their ops chief and now fire chief was also on the panel. So we had some diverse partners on the serious accident review team to do that. So it's good that you brought that up, Barry, because we had individuals that managed and were of leadership of other departments they had gone through, very similar, almost identical building construction, size, all that stuff. So good note.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead, Jim.
No, you go.
It's interesting to me. We keep talking about training and, you know, standard operating procedures and all of these things. And, you know, in one of our classes, one of the people said, well, we go up on the roof every single time. And I just kind of like, I'm not going to argue or try to tell you how to do your job, but I don't get that to me. I mean, I want to be looking at that building, deciding on what's going on there. And what's the proper procedure to take? I'm not going to do it just because, like you said, that's the way we've always done it. And then about a month later, I saw a video of one of their guys, and he goes up on the roof, and he's got a rubbish hook in his hand, not using it, and he falls right through the roof. And it's like, well, I just don't get it, guys. I don't get it. We keep harping on training and how you walk a roof and what you're and what's, you know, proper tactics, and guys just let their guard down, and I don't know why that happens. But whenever I see a guy go through a roof, it's just gut-wrenching to me.
So I'd like to add there, JJ said, you know, from the firefighter perspective, because, I mean, I'm a firm believer. You guys have heard my little tidbits of philosophy. And, you know, when I say firefighter, I'm not speaking about just the firefighter. I'm speaking of all operational suppressional personnel that are responding to incidents, because whether you're a driver operator or the engineer, you're a company officer, a lieutenant if you're running that system, any type of chief officer, in order to be good in that rank, you still have to be a good firefighter. So, you know, a good engineer is a good firefighter with more responsibility on safely navigating apparatus, operating all the devices and equipment on that apparatus. A company officer needs to be a really damn good firefighter that understands the engineer ranks, with more responsibility in that risk management and emotion control, being that setting the example so that your crew has competency, not just that we prove capability at some point in time, and so on and so forth. So, like, terminology, it's funny, Barry, I heard you say, you know, when the truck arrives, they go to the roof. And that's so much of a problem because, like, in my op area, we started saying, hey, ventilation group. But ventilation group, meaning functional versus roof, geographical, but yet they still go to the roof. The maxi set on the truck, a ladder goes to the closest side of the building, usually the alpha side, unless you're dealing with, you know, some kind of multi-dwelling where you're down an alley or something. But you get the point that the ladder goes to the closest point, the saws are running, and they go up. And realistically, when it comes to suppressional firefighting, the art of fighting fire, and you take the science that's been provided, and you look at flow path and heat release rate, and you look at the dynamics of the pressure problem based on the amount of fire involvement and area involvement, whether it's one room, a room extending, multiple rooms, a floor. When you start calculating the GPM required, your line placement, line size, nozzle application patterns, and everything that goes into a choreographed or coordinated attack, we've got to come back to ventilation profile is what's going to drive what you do, because how you ventilate that structure, how you're getting water in to combat the heat release rate, the energy being released, is all going to come into that. So I think terminology is something that's being missed. So it means something. If you say ventilation group, or I need you to look at coordinating a horizontal profile, we have to stop the emotion of driving, I have to go to the roof. Because a lot of times you look at structures in the aftermath, including Cortland, you go look at where all the vertical ventilation holes were placed other than the man-made one over the garage, there's clean, unburned structural members to tell you there's no extension or major fire development in that space. You know, path of least resistance, you look at the pressure problem, and you start looking at garage fires, which are common, attached or detached. Complexity goes up with attached. This one in the Cortland, to be clear, did not have an interior man door. The man door compared to the vehicle door, so you're using terminology when you say door, well, which one are you talking about? Well, if you say vehicle door, we know it's the one you put the vehicles through that go to the driveway, which is almost one quarter size of the standard 400 square feet on a two-car garage versus a man door. Now the question is, does the man door go to the exterior or the interior? A lot of times it's assumed it's interior because it's more common. You can pull your car in, the grocery getter, the soccer mom, and they take the groceries through the door into the kitchen area or a dining area right off the kitchen. That's common layout under building construction, and we should understand that because the pressure is going to do that. So terminology means something. Understanding ventilation profile under flow path means something. And I'll tell you, a takeaway, especially with no savable life, when we've confirmed everyone's out, your tactical priority at a task level is remove the vehicle door. Dump that pressure and heat into the driveway so it's not pushing into the structure. And I'm not saying you can't coordinate multiple things at multiple times. It's just we routinely miss, and we want to go interior and fight fire from man doors or look for the extension and a little bit of smoke. We assume it's extended, and that's just not the case most of the time.
Yeah. I like it. thinking about this too and reading the report, a friend of mine, Ben Rosenbaum, is a captain in Idaho, and he was telling me about an incident they had, which was maybe like a 4,000 or 5,000 square foot wood frame commercial building, like had offices that was kind of split up, and they it was a mutual aid fire, and they got there and they were ventilation, so they get up on the roof and he's sounding away, and he's got good stable decking, and then he goes a little bit further, and then all of a sudden it's like super soft, and then he goes back over, and again like real stable, and then right over, and there was a draft stopping because building code, once a common attic space reaches a certain size, you have to be able to separate that, and so it was the fire had stopped in that draft stopping, so it was super solid on one side, and then compromised on the other. So that's kind of something I was thinking about with this as well, is it talks about having good sounding, and then as soon as he crossed over that firewall, basically where he fell. So something is like thinking about that as if you're a firefighter, is going topside, looking at the compartment and being kind of that building construction knowledge or that size up knowledge of kind of visualizing where those spaces like a garage or where those changes of construction methods might be. So something that popped into my head.
Yeah, JJ, you bring that up, and you look at when you ladder or even pulling up on one side, you can clearly see based on construction features and the ridge and where the gables are at, you can easily mark out the attachment points and where that firewall should be between the attic space of the garage and the attic space of the house. So again, we've kind of pushed in the fire service for decades that get up over the fire or as close to up over the fire as you can. And when you come back to that, it's a pressure problem of path of least resistance, and that overheat and pressure with smoke and fire is going to go to a lower pressured area because the fire is what's dominating, creating pressure. So atmospheric pressure being lower than the pressures the fire's producing, hence why it comes billowing out. You can see your conditions. You should be able to model that path of least resistance. And if you are going to do topside ventilation of any sort, you don't need to be over that area. And we treat things as routine. It's not a very big structure. It's single family, single story. And we kind of get a little complacent as a whole because we think it's not that big of a deal. But, here again, we've proven everything should be a big deal until proven otherwise.
Mm-hmm. That's Barry, that's like what you talk about in the class every time, right?
The bread and butter fire, Every time I hear somebody say I was a bread and butter fire, I want to punch them in the face because there's no such thing, So that, 1,200 square foot single family dwelling, single story, it'll get you. So pay attention, If you're that relaxed and that cool that you think it's a bread and butter fire, you probably should find another profession because you're going to get somebody hurt or yourself, in my opinion.
Another takeaway on that, and routine fire. Okay, we don't have to over emotionally analyze, but we definitely don't want to underestimate the potential. So that's that forward progressive thinking, just like stretching hose, just like ladder placement, just like setting up two outer rick. You got to be proactive in your actions and be in a true state of readiness with the proper PPE on, ready to go, with the tool cache and knowing the proper tool for the job and how to more so utilize that tool. So as all these things come together, you don't want to be reactive on the fire ground. Once you're there, all your training experience and those slides that you're drawn from should be helping you realize those cues and clues, put it into factual data based on your experience, and then apply your skill sets to make it better. JJ was reading the opening there, and like heavy smoke showing, what does that mean? All three of us could give you a different definition, but that's their perception. That's okay. But a good 360 and a report on conditions, if you need more cues and clues, will help you validate what my original size up that I saw, am I in the appropriate mode of operation, are we attacking this thing in the right manner? Because heavy smoke showing from a single window versus the building is a big difference. Heavy smoke and fire showing from the second floor single window is different than 4,000 or 5,000 square feet like JJ's describing on that other one. So if we don't put things in perspective so that every set of eyes coming to the fire on the additional engines and trucks that are responding on your first alarm, your integrated, your working, your seconds, whatever terminology you guys use out there who's listening, if you pull on scene and the size up was so general that you're like, okay, it doesn't tell me anything, you should be able to pull up to say, is it getting better? Is it staying the same? Or is it getting worse? That allows you to start calculating risk. This incident from time ago and until time at the hospital, they said 15 minutes. I think it's important to recognize most agencies at an industry standard have set their first benchmark from their comm center, their ECC, at a 15-minute benchmark. You have 15 minutes on the incident clock, and you're okay. No, that's a time to validate. Are we in this still in the right strategic mode of operation? Is it getting better or worse? Because of the time lags on doing a tactical retreat, pulling people to safe locations, and all that. So people are getting hurt before that first benchmark. That's concerning.
Yeah. And something, too, with that, you look at that time frame that you just talked about, that 15 minutes to what that was him at the hospital. That is a department that is on scene very fast and getting to work very fast. So you look at like a lot of rural departments or composite or anything like that. You're looking at people starting to get to work at that time, let alone, you know, the incident being like wrapped up almost. So that's something big to consider too, is, you know, a lot of times we look at like, and if you come from a smaller agency, you look and compare yourself to larger organizations. But the amount of work that can be accomplished and the time frame is just so much different. That's something we're dealing with some building code stuff here in Canada to do with protection of floor systems and trying to come up with time frames. And it's like impossible. Vancouver, we have 4 minutes and we're on scene. And then you go, 30 minutes away and it could be 20 minutes before somebody's on scene. So it's, that stuff is differences in time frames, and then that directly impacts how things go.
Tim, one of the things you said about, all the eyes getting on that scene, and it was really important to me to have, when my guys got off the rig, they were looking at the building and they had some kind of concept of what we have for a building, what's going on in that building, where is the fire, where is it going. The captain, the officer, is not the only guy that should be looking at that building paying attention. If you're getting off the rig and you know that you're supposed to throw a ladder and that's the only thing you're thinking about, then we got a problem. You got to be thinking of 100 different things while you're throwing that ladder. So it's really important that, you're going out, riding your district, looking at your buildings, walking, talking, exchanging information, looking at incidents like this, so that every guy on that rig is a firefighter. He's not just taking up, he or she is not just taking up space. And that to me is really important.
Absolutely. Yeah, you got to be engaged. You got to be an ambassador, your own safety, your own career. I find around the kitchen table, we tend to get along to go along, and we're lacking the leadership or the ability for lower ranked people to step up, because they very well are often, with their experiences, especially with a lot in my area, we get a lot of people moving departments because of schedules and money and everything else. But we get people coming in and you want to say, oh, he's just a rookie firefighter. No such thing as just a firefighter, especially just a rookie firefighter, when they've got 10, 12, and 15 years in another agency. And we've gotten quite a few people in engineer and captain ranks from other departments that are just outstanding, solid firefighters that have that ability to supervise and lead and then manage that stuff, because we tend to confuse management and leadership, and leadership has no rank. Management position comes with that, but that doesn't mean the firefighter can't be the one to bring up that safety concern or the fact that we should be doing something a little different at the task level to help manage that incident. One that I think is often overlooked, as you were speaking, Barry, is talking about all those things and the size up and the building construction, but they'll say, hey, we got smoke showing on the Bravo side and paint the picture of the fires over there, but then they got a 20-mile-an-hour wind hitting the Delta side. Well, no kidding, the smoke is on the Bravo side because the wind is pushing it there. Right. So those are those things of complacency that without a good 360 to validate your initial impression, you're often operating in the lucky devil mode of assumption. And that's where we need to take that tactical pause or deep breath, whatever resonates to you, and get good, solid information. You know, I hear so often the engine or the truck coming in and, hey, we're 30 seconds out. Do you have an assignment? And they're really 2 minutes out and another engine beats them there, and they're putting that pressure, creating that urgency on that first in company officer or that team that's already there. We create these urgencies based on the assignment I want or trying to be on the nozzle or trying to operate a saw on the roof, and we've got to knock that off. That's quite frankly the reason why these near misses, these injuries, these tragic events leading to death happen, because we create the urgency of trying to get the assignment we want or to go do what we want to do versus accepting these cues and clues through good pre-planning, walking buildings, evaluating weather and building construction when you get there, and then looking at the potential of the fire problem, where it's going to spread to, volume, ardor reading, smoke, fire dynamics, all that stuff that comes into it should be validating a plan, not just going, I hope it all works out. You know, nothing worse than losing a building or getting someone hurt. And at the end, during an after-action review, you see some clown say, well, the fire went out, nobody got hurt. No, somebody did get hurt, or we almost killed three people. But that's that whole, what's our attitude towards it? How are we really evaluating our career and the competency levels of how we're applying all-risk firefighting? So, you know, you can see I can go off on tangents to go around, but it gets really frustrating when we're just doing things because we want to, and we're creating urgency and putting pressure on guys in all the wrong ways. You know, we've got our good friend up there to the north that always says, you know, the trash man, and I know he got it from somebody else, but the trash man doesn't go around the corner and say, oh, my God, another trash can. Yet we go to a working fire, and guys are just so jacked up, and their adrenaline is outpacing their ability to think because they fall back on their training, which was Academy 101, and they're the two-year fireman that's 5 or 10 times over, and we wonder why things happen. I don't wonder at all. It's quite clear in my book. So hopefully that's the attitude and behaviors we change through blogs and sharing of information like this tonight.
We had a lot of discussions in Battalion 1 in San Jose. It was the downtown battalion, and a lot of older company officers and a lot of pride, you know, and we had a lot of discussion about why were we racing to the scene? I mean, if we could beat the first in company, the first new company, that was cool. Well, we started talking about that and said, this is dumb, you guys. We can't be doing this stuff. It's very unprofessional. It's very dangerous. And you know, we even got to the point where it's like, don't rush the first due officer into giving a report. And the first due officer we finally said, okay, if I get there and I'm sizing the building up, I'm going to tell everybody, you know, stand by for assignment. Just, in other words, give me a couple seconds to figure out where we're going to go with this thing. And it worked really well, because we were doing just exactly what you're talking about, Timmy. And it wasn't, we thought it was working, but it wasn't. So we finally fixed it, and it worked much, much better, much better.
Yeah.
Okay, I got a couple things I want to discuss. The first one is just changing the course of the discussion a little bit, but Tim, you brought up the fact that that with this, with the Courtland incident, that it had, like, they talk in the report about the man door in the garage, but that man door exited through an exterior wall. It wasn't like what you typically think with a garage where you walk, like you said, where you walk into the residence. For me, I live in an area where all, like, I'd say a huge majority of the homes have that, an attached garage where you can walk actually into the living space. But where I work in Vancouver, I would say that's very rare, especially on the east side. They're all, you know, 100-year-old homes where, you know, real tight lot lines, you know, the eaves overhanging on the building or the house next to it. Like, so I don't run into that. Do you guys think, is that something that's really common for you guys to see, is that, you know, that door straight into the living space? And then does that change your priorities or your attack, knowing that there, you know, there is a door or some sort of a way leading into the, to the occupiable space, as opposed to it just being a separate space?
Yeah, for me, it is very common on the West Coast, and depending on the air, you know, my grandfather, coming out of World War II, bought a new development of a city called Norwalk in LA County, and he bought an 1,100 square foot home. It might not have even been that. It had a single car attached garage that did not have entry, you know, and that whole neighborhood's that way. So no matter what your norms are, Barry had brought it up, you got to be out driving your district and knowing your first in. But in my area in Anaheim, kind of the north side of Orange County and Southern California, it's very common that attached garages, more often than not, depending on the era of construction, you know, there's never a one way of doing it, but when that building was built, unless it went through some pretty extreme remodels, it's pretty standard if you know your first in. And for us, whether it's a 2 or 3 car attached garage up in Anaheim Hills, we've got some big custom homes. More times than not, to the high 90th percentile, it's got an interior man door that connects the storage space, which is one set of codes, to the interior living space, which is a whole separate set of codes. Hence why that man door connecting that is a solid core door to meet the rating, and it's double type X drywall all the way up through the roof structure.
Yeah, that's pretty much the same up in Northern California too, JJ.
Mm-hmm.
You know, almost all of them have a door going into the interior of the house. Some have both an interior door and an exterior door,
mm-hmm.
you know. But, you know, that's, you don't know that coming in, so you're going to have to find that out probably
yeah.
in most cases when you get on scene.
Katie, so the second part of that is, that does that change the way you fight that fire? Absolutely. You know, when you look at Courtland, they stretched a line to the interior based on the way it evolved in the first couple minutes. They thought it had extension. They were reporting it in the attic. They poked some holes to clearly see it wasn't. Later on, they said they were getting it. It's that minor poke through. Again, it's the pressure problem, path of least resistance. But when they stretch that line through and then open that door that went to the outside, they can clearly see the fire exiting that door. And you could do a quick analysis of the heat release rate based on volume, looking at the smoke, the indraft, where that neutral plane was at, you could start going through, you know. Just a quick side note, I was down at Firehouse World in San Diego after this, and this isn't picking on any one person, because we realize there's a lot of emotion that goes into being a part of an agency that's turning itself inside out, that has tragically injured one of their members through a facet of history. So, you know, we're in, after some classes, and I'm with a good friend of mine, Kevin Albertson. He's a chief officer in Bakersfield, been a great mentor and friend to me. But we were there, and this guy starts talking about it, and he was just pounding on the SART team and kind of you know, very emotional on what we were saying or what we did and going on and on. He's like, you know, this isn't all true. And I said, hey, let him vent. He's venting. This is part of the healing process and going on. And after about an hour, he finally mentioned to this individual, says, hey, do you know who this guy is? He's like, no. We just kind of ended up congregating in a group and everyone's listening to this guy because it was a big topic. And he says, yeah, he said my name and, you know, I was part of it. And man, it got a little tight there, I'll say. I respected his opinion. And I finally said, hey, the one thing you're missing here in all this emotion that I get, I understand, is that you think we're judging your entire organization based on one hose lay or one fire. And that's not the case. But when you look at the facts of this fire, these mistakes, some of the mistakes you're speaking of, happened on that fire. Nowhere did we say it happened on all of them. Because like Barry said, Fresno's a very progressive, very active fire department. They were just a little stuck in their own bubble. Captain Dern, he was their ventilation, well-respected truck operations guy. He wrote a lot of their policies and stuff. Where I challenge it is what progression was made to compare it as time went on to other industry standards, to building construction, to updates, to modern fire dynamics that UL and NIST have put out, you know, millions of dollars and stuff, to update and adapt to continue those rich traditions that were still working tactically at task levels, but adapt it to modern building construction, modern times, the influence of weather, relative humidity, all those things that play into every fire, because fire is fire. It burns the same whether it's a matchstick out and well open to a trash can to a dumpster to a room and contents to a wildland. Fire behavior is the same. It's how it's configured and confined and what starts to burn to give that energy release is what changes. But the chemistries and the action is the same. So, you know, coming back around, you still look at, it's very emotional, and you got to sometimes take back that emotion and apply the facts. Mm-hmm. That way you can make that, because the facts of that neutral plane in that door of 400 square feet in unprotected structural, not flowing enough water, flowing a less desirable nozzle pattern in the overhead, stopping the exhaust of that superheated gases and that pressure and shutting down, goes to show why firefighters shouldn't be in division group leadership positions to manage fires. They should, when you're on a nozzle, your sole job should be squirting water, and the backup guy should be controlling your pinch points, getting it. You know, I hate when you're on fires and you hear a guy on a nozzle yell hose. That tells me everyone behind them isn't managing that hose and preloading rooms, controlling pinch points. And then you hear the next guy yell hose, and the next guy. It's like three or four guys are on a hose line, and they're all yelling hose. Well, who's in charge of managing the hose? If you don't have enough hose, a pre-connect doesn't go through a small single-family dwelling that should reach all four corners and go through the house. There's an efficiency issue that was skipped on that fire at that time. So, you know, you start applying all these different things. Flowing water, those conditions could have been drastically different when the individual did go through the roof if we were actually doing suppressional firefighting with modern fire dynamic knowledge based on UL and NIST studies.
For sure. Okay, guys, I want to hear your thoughts on something else too that's a little, you know, maybe not directly related to this, but as I was reading the incident overview, it talked about a couple of the firefighters or officers that, and they use the terminology independent action. So meaning, you know, basically what I'm interpreting that as what we would call like freelancing, like, you know, doing something like that. And then as we were talking about, like even Barry talking about racing to the scene, we typically up in our area, the way that we don't run off of, pre-arrival assignments, essentially. Like if we show up, whoever's the incident commander is going to start asking for people that are in some sort of a staging. And I know down in California, there's a lot, or the down your area, there's lots of that pre-arrival where if you're the first in engine, you're doing this. If you're the first in truck, you're, you know, you have assignment. What are your thoughts on those two things and kind of some of the positives and negatives of that? Because I think sometimes you, like, I think there's, you know, positives and negatives from both, but I think sometimes you can run into issues with, you know, that independent action, maybe not what the incident commander may want, or maybe kind of the direction of the fire with those pre-arrival assignments. But then on the flip side of it, if you're just sitting there and staging, waiting for somebody to tell you what to do, there's definitely big downsides to that. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah. It makes a lot of sense. You've heard me say this a number of times, JJ, that, you know, I'm the first through truck. I don't need you to give me an assignment, you know, on a single family dwelling. You know, we're not talking about things that are going to 2 and 3 alarms, but on a single family dwelling, I get there on the truck. I should know what I need to do. Okay. Unless there's something specific that the first due that the IC needs me to do, I should know what I need to do. It always irritated me to hear the second due engine go, standing by the hydrant waiting for an assignment. Okay. Do you think the first due company is not so busy that they don't have time to babysit your sorry ass and tell you what you should be doing, and you should know that already? I think there should be, you know, you should have some kind of idea of what you're going to do when you get there. Pre-assigned stuff. Yeah, definitely. I think it should be pre-assigned stuff. But if you're just standing by waiting for an assignment, you're wasting a lot of time, in my opinion, on a single alarm structure fire. Okay. Go ahead, Timmy. You can eat me up on that.
No, I mean, to me, it's this is where, you know, every I don't even want to say department at this standpoint, because I think most agencies, the bigger you are, the more incidents you'll have with just your agency. But if you're working with any kind of automatic aid agreements or automatic mutual aid agreements, you know, that's a regional approach so that we can operate safely together with hopefully known. That kind of goes back to the terminology. We do, to a high likelihood, have preset known assignments that will be done by what order you arrive in. Mm-hmm. I think a couple things that change that are what mode of operation we're in. You know, when you're in the offensive mode doing incident stabilization through fire control for property conservation versus rescue, it's two completely different things to operate in different ways. Justifying unprotected search versus protected search, meaning hose line or not, and having those known terminologies. We do not go as low as having predetermined seat assignments. So the first due truck, the engineer and the firefighter do this, the captain and the firefighter 4 or second firefighter do that. We don't break it down that far, but we do operate in Orange County under, it's called the Orange County Annex. And for us, it's just the regional policies that every agency has recognized and have standard operating positions. And we use that really for great alarm fire, high rise, things like that. Coming back to you kind of opened it, JJ, with, you know, freelancing and independent action. We really try to preach there is a difference in that. We tend to make them synonymous, and a lot of places they are. But is it positive or negative? Are you working within the commander's intent or not? So we like to say freelancing means you're doing willy-nilly, you're just taking action, and it's really not in the best interest, or you're creating negative environments for others on that emergency incident. Where independent action, you know, you're taking actions that are within incident stabilization, within that commander's intent, because we want our company officers and our firefighters that are taking action to think. And we want them to think safely, and we want them to think in terms of my actions are helping stabilize and mitigate this incident versus, you know, uncontrolled ventilation, breaking windows, and taking freelancing skills that change the ventilation profile that increased the heat release rate, and hose lines aren't in place. We're popping roofs vertically without coordinating the interior, and there's no suppression effort going on. So when there's a lack of coordination, it negatively impacts. To us, we classify that as freelancing. For us in Southern California or the West Coast, we have a ton of wildfire problems. This last year really kicked our butts pretty good with, you know, they always say it's going to be the worst fire season ever. I would say it was one of our worst fire seasons ever, if not the worst. You know, I spent 68 days out of county, and that's normal for a lot of our Cal Fire brothers. But it was a unique year for me and the contributions. But you need independent action in the WUI wildland environment because the fires escalate and grow so big so fast, and you got structures burning over 10 square miles because of Santa Ana wind conditions, that you can't provide direction in all aspects of that. So independent action is needed, clarifying that you're doing it safely and you're not negatively impacting those other units and agencies that are assisting with the incident.
I'm glad you broke it down like that, because like you said, as soon as you say freelancing, it's got a negative connotation to it. Where I like that idea of the terminology for the independent action, because like for me, there's I firmly believe that when you're operating at a scene, there's times where you have to do things that may be slightly outside of what you've been directed to do based on the conditions that you see or what presents itself, and you know, kind of making those decisions. When it gets lumped into freelancing, all of a sudden it becomes a negative thing, where, you know, even just having that terminology within your organization of independent action, and like you said, as long as it goes with the overall direction of the fire and is not going to negatively contribute to anything, I like that separation, having the two different terminology.
That was well said, Timmy. And like my thing is independent action, you know, but if you're doing independent action, you need to let people know what you're doing. Okay. If I'm the first truck and I know what I'm going to do and I'm doing something, I need to let that IC know, okay, we're going to the roof, or we're, you know, forcing the door in the back or whatever, you know, then it's part of the overall plan. But the freelancing, you know, if you're just doing stupid stuff and not telling anybody what you're doing and didn't get an assignment and it was not pre-planned in any way, shape, or form, then you're going to cause trouble.
Yeah, you know, Barry, you had said, like, in your analogy on a single-story, single-family dwelling, you know, under 1,500 square feet, when you only have one truck, you're either going to, if there's rescue, you're going to go for search. If there's, you know, everyone's confirmed out of the building or there's no survivability profile, then you're going to be coordinating ventilation efforts. That's pretty standard for West Coast.
Right.
I think that's a lot the same for you up there, JJ, but it comes back to, have you trained? Are you communicating? You know, it's like working with that partner for a lot of years that you train a lot with and have respect. You look and you kind of move your one eye one way and he knows exactly what you mean. Kind of like when your wife looks at you and you know you're in trouble and you probably know why, even though you act like you don't know why. It's that nonverbal things or that one word that paints a huge picture of what the end state's supposed to look like. And, you know, you shouldn't have to say, and I want you to do it safely without getting hurt. But I feel like a lot of times when, like, as a chief officer, I respond in and a command established and you go up there and you say, okay, what do you got? What are we trying to do? And he says, well, right now, you know, they kind of give you, okay, you're stating some pretty obvious things. And they say, and we're trying to put the fire out. It's like, you know, I'm really trying not to cuss because I'm not good at that. But you feel like saying, no shit, the fire department showed up to a working structure fire and we're trying to put it out. And that's the summary of their actions on what they're trying to do. But is it containing it to a room? Is it containing it to a floor? Is it protecting an exposure? Is it still trying to remove all occupants from the building, you know, versus search? We've got to talk in terminology that the task and tactical priorities are matching a strategy that you're in, and it's a validated strategy, under incident priorities or objectives. What are the two or three main key things that we're doing? And then are we breaking it down in a fashion that was short, precise terms that everybody knows what's going on? And I'm sorry, the only way you're going to accomplish that is, and I'm not going to say through department policy. I think we have way too many of them, but they should be done under a foundation, a culture of good standard operating guidelines that are fluid, that paint a picture, that are adjustable and adaptable in order to have the flexibility to make decisions from a left boundary and a right boundary to safely manage the risk and mitigate these injuries or incidents without injuring our first responders or, God forbid, killing them. And that's where we're just missing that priority through cultural norms of how important training is, how important terminology is, and how important, football teams is the common one we've all heard. You know, they have a game on Sunday. What do they do on Monday? They review tapes and they apply what went well. They look at variables of where they could have done something different, and they identify under certain circumstances when we absolutely shouldn't do something. You know, nothing worse than going to after action review where somebody got hurt or, something major went on. And then at the end, the guy says, but I'll do the same thing all over again. It's like, you know what? Knock it off. Check your ego. You had me right up until then. I thought, you know, he's humble. He's sharing his experience. I'm learning from it. He does that. And I'm going, what a dumbass. I have zero respect now. Mm-hmm. We got to knock that stuff off.
Awesome. Yeah.
One example, JJ, you know, the guys from Sac City, great, great guys, really knowledgeable, train all the time, love those guys. But, you know, if their truck gets on scene and they say, we're splitting, everybody knows what they're talking about, you know. He's sending two guys to the roof and two guys inside. Done, you know. So, and then the second truck knows that they split, so now what am I going to do, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So those kinds of terms are important that everybody understands what's being shown on the fire ground and what that company's doing.
Awesome. So we've been going for just over an hour here, about an hour mark. Kim, do you have anything else from this incident? I know as I was doing the overview, you said you made some notes. Is there anything else you want to touch on or feel, takeaways or important things to pass on to the listeners before we start to close this out?
You know, JJ, first and foremost, I appreciate that you and Barry inviting me to share the experience. And I think you can see I really have tried to address it more in general and in cultural norms of know why you're doing it. Have a thought process. More importantly, be engaged in an ambassador of a profession. You know, it seems like more and more we like it as a career, but we treat it as a job. And it really should be, you know, we're respectful and humbled to have this career, and we want to provide service and be servant leaders to our community and knowing the art of firefighting and rescue and all the things that we have to do to be professional firefighters. And, you know, I've always been so privileged to be in this profession and this job, but the Cortland incident kind of drove our conversations, but you know, guys need to just read it. They need to engage with it. We've had some near misses and some Mayday activations up here. Orange County had a fire the other day with an interior firefight that started exterior. There's a Durango incident. Green Sheet just came out in Riverside County. Another progressive, very aggressive fire department within Cal Fire. That, you know, there's always lessons learned, but a lot of them are the causal contributing factors or history repeating themselves. So I can end it and answer any questions, but the biggest takeaway is it comes back to what is your engagement level in your career? How are you seeking knowledge? What knowledge are you making fact based on who's telling you? What's the factual industry standard, what's backing that up? Or are you just retired on duty, you know, and that fast transition there. But we've got a lot of firefighters that argue what we deserve and earn. But then when it's hitting the fan and it's time to earn it, we have excuses of why we didn't pull it off, or what we will and won't do, and what we will train and train at, and when we won't. And it comes back to, I mean, you know, in being part of the SoCal TOs and the Training Officers Association of California, at State Fire Training, when they're looking at trying to validate our profession through NFPA standards and terminal and enabling learning objectives to justify the things that we do, you know, the cops have posts, hairdressers, they have to do more legal required continued education credits a year in their profession than we have to as structural firefighters. So, mm-hmm. you know, you got to just put an attitude and your best foot forward it that you chose a profession, that you're a service provider, you're a blue-collared worker, and we get treated very well and are still very well respected in our community. Let's not lose it. Mm-hmm. The best way to do that is go to work every day, train your heart out, and be prepared. Like I tell my guys, you're training for 5 calls in your career that you're going to truly make a difference to one of your brothers or sisters. We make a difference every day, no doubt. And right now amongst COVID and setting up vaccine clinics and everything, we make a difference and provide for our community every day. But training really comes down to those all-risk incidents when it's truly hitting the fan, and you need people that learn how to think on their feet and be individual leaders within their rank that make a difference and truly save another first responder's life and keep them from getting injured or killed or rescue that civilian. That's mm-hmm. why we're here. That's what we need to do, not be reactive and hope everything goes well. Like I said, I'll answer questions specifically, but I'll end my long-winded, very general, and, you know, the heart has to be backed up.
Absolutely. I think that's a pretty damn good place to end it. I don't know if we get much better than that.
So. I'm good. All right.
Awesome. Well, Tim, we'll have to have you on again when we do another show and have a topic that, knowing you, you can you could talk about anything. So we'll definitely have you back on at some point for once we have something good to chat about. It was awesome hearing your feedback. And if anyone listening in, Tim, wants to get in touch with you, what would be the best way? If they have more questions about this or about some of the training you offer or anything like that, how would they get in touch with you?
Yeah, I mean, the easiest way, I'd love to throw my phone number out there, but I'm afraid what that might do.
Don't do that.
especially those that might want to dot my I by now and stop me in the nose. But easy thing is do, I'll give my email out there, tadams@anaheim.net. for professional contacts, since we're tying it back to the Dern incident and representing my organization there. So tadams@anaheim.net, send me an email, let me know what you're pleased, displeased with, and I'll be glad to chat. Definitely different ways to do it and different perspectives. But if we need to clarify anything to make sure it stays positive and that we're reinforcing the leadership that Fresno gave on the Cortland incident, and trying to grow your knowledge base, reach out to that, and I'll do anything I can for you. But I appreciate you having me on.
Awesome. Cool. Awesome. Well, thanks again, Tim. We appreciate it. It's always fun to chat. And Barry, as always, in the last number of years, this is probably the longest that we haven't been able to see each other.
I know. Hey, thanks, Timmy. Thank you, Timmy. It was great hooking up with you, pal.
Yep, good seeing you guys. Happy New Year.
Right,
awesome. Well, everyone, thanks for tuning in to The Built Environment, and we'll see you next time.